This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're at, in the U.S. or around the world. Thanks for joining us on the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge, the status quo, and I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it. And a very happy Father's Day to everybody in the U.S. and around the world, especially if your father passed away and you will miss him tremendously today. And I know my dad passed away a year ago. You'll miss him for the rest of your life. So just enjoy that you had a great father and enjoy Father's Day. Remember all the great memories of the fathers who passed away. So again, happy Father's Day to everybody. And I want to welcome ESPN, obviously, Honolulu. Folks, thanks for listening to the show on the website and everybody else that is on Facebook and on LinkedIn, along with, don't forget, we're also on YouTube. So one favor, go to baseballoutsidethebox.com. Audio, subscribe, and also Facebook, YouTube, subscribe. That just helps us get the show out. As you know, we're in over 100 countries, and we appreciate all your help in getting the show out. And yes, we haven't been on for a week. It's almost like we took off 2 weeks because in between we had a couple shows. I apologize, but we have been house hunting, and that's so important to us because we're making a big move. And when you make a big move, you want to make the right one. So again, apologize for not having the shows, but we are back, and we'll be having almost one a day. Let me welcome our guest on Father's Day. Hey, listen, I know you folks are going to say, well, you picked another Italian. Well, you know, it just happens this way. It happens to be on Father's Day. Tony Cappuccelli, he's player development with the Dodgers. All the coaches are with the Dodgers are in player development, but he's the manager of the Arizona League team there. He's got a tremendous amount of experience because he's got high school, college, and professional experience. He's also got international experience, an envoy program in Germany. He played in Spain, so he's got a lot of background. To me, he's a young man, but again, here we go. The Dodgers bringing in great coaches, young people who understand the game, who also open up the game, who have that outside-the-box thinking. As you all know, a good friend of mine who played for me with the Schaumburg Flyers, Ryan Cienko, is with the Dodgers. And again, here there's another guy that opens up the world on catching and makes you think all the time. So let me welcome to the show, Tony Cappuccelli. What's up, Tony?
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for being on the show. And I got to apologize. I'll do it on air because, folks, you know, Tony, we've been going back and forth for a while. He's been really available. And the problem is every time I schedule something with him, something comes up with me with the travel. I got to cancel on him. So he's been fantastic. A lot of guys might get a little upset saying, hey, you know, you cancel on me too much, but not Tony. Good Italian and glad to have him on the show. Hey, listen, I only mentioned a few things on your background, but I think interesting enough, there's a lot of young people that are getting into the game. I know when I got into the game, you know, a long time ago, it was tough to get in pro ball because it was a good old boys network back then, you know, and it was kind of closed. And if you didn't play even in the minors, you didn't have a chance. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's a little bit different, but still not easy. You just don't get in the pro ball any way you want. I'd like to hear about how you got in the pro ball after, you know, being a volunteer coach at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Irvine Valley College, you know, Edison High School, the coach in the Alaskan League. So it's not like, you had experience, obviously, but talk about how you got in.
In terms of pro ball, you know, my, it was really weird. So my wife, my girlfriend at the time, we're ready to head back to Las Vegas for Thanksgiving. And I got an email from Gabe Kapler, who was the Dodgers director of player development at the time. Kind of just reaching out and wanted to have a conversation. And, you know, we started texting, we had some phone calls, and it really didn't even dawn on me for a little while that I was being interviewed for a job. Just the way he held the conversation, I just felt like we were chatting. It was very, very weird. I mean, I was expecting an interview to be a lot more, official sounding versus that conversation. And it dawned on me after a little while. I told my wife, I'm like, I think I'm getting interviewed for a job. I mean, this is weird. because at the time, you know, when I was at New Mexico, we had a lot of really good players. And I thought, you know, this was actually about going to lead into, you know, some stuff about some of our guys that were potential draft picks and guys the Dodgers may be interested in. So I really didn't think too much of it. And we went through the process, you know, talked to some people from the organization. And the first time, like, I didn't get the job. I was told that they were going to hire somebody else in the position they were interviewing me for. You know, at the time I hadn't even thought about going into pro ball. So it was, you know, really, I hadn't entertained that until I started having those conversations, thinking that this is an actual, you know, possibility of you know, maybe that it would happen with the Dodgers. So we went through our season in 17 with New Mexico, and he called me up, July probably of that year after our season. And I was running some camps in Albuquerque. And, you know, basically he called and said, "Hey, we have a spot that, you know, is opened up. Would you be interested?" I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely." Cause at the time I'd already left New Mexico and I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do. I had a junior college job here in Arizona that I was going to come take, but, you know, obviously the opportunity to work for the Dodgers coming up was, you know, enticing for sure. So when he said the possibility was there, I said, "Yeah, let's do it." And then he called me about a week later and said, "Yeah, we want to offer you the job." So we were actually already moving out here, to take this other job at junior college. And so it actually worked out perfectly that we wound up here in Arizona and I started coaching in the Arizona League, in the summer of 17.
Yeah. What a great place, and being home and being able to coach there at home for the Dodgers. What a great thing. Mm-hmm. So, and he talked about the interview. You know, that's kind of interesting because here we go again, outside the box thinking a little bit, because, you know, why have a typical interview? A typical interview, everybody's prepared for. Here's one where you're just having a conversation and you didn't even know you're being interviewed. In some ways, that brings the best out of you in some ways. In some ways, you know, they get the feeling of who you really are.
Yeah, I think it's going to lead to more of an authentic conversation. You know, like when you have an idea of what they're going to ask and how they're going to ask it and, you know, what they want to hear, I think you cater your answers towards, you know, saying what you think they want to hear. So when a situation comes up later on, that was, you know, maybe something that was presented to you, and your response is not the way that you answered in your interview because you're catering it to, you know, what you think they want to hear versus being authentic to yourself or how you would actually respond in that situation. You end up, you know, not having a response that you really should have or that you believe in yourself, because it wasn't you answering that question. You're doing it for the sake of giving a response that you thought they wanted to hear. So the conversation piece was huge.
And for our coaches, you know, that's a great point. For our coaches that may get into interviews, or players that are going to go into coaching, that's an important aspect because, you know, I'd rather that you give your answer that you believe in than the answer that you think they want you to give, and not get the job. I mean, if it's something you believe in and they don't want you for that, well, then that's life, but that's what you believe in. You could always change later on, but I would think you got to go with what your belief system is.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, like the hitting revolution that's going on right now. And, you know, everybody wants to hit a ball as high as humanly possible. It's great and all, but if you're going to go into an interview for a hitting coach position and, you know, you're going to talk about, yeah, we're going to talk launch angle and everything's got to be in the air. And then when it's time to go coach, you know, you want to get your foot down early and chop straight down, hit ground balls to the right side. Like that's not going to fly. You know, that's how you get fired really quickly. So there's no sense in trying to just get a job based off what you think people want to hear, because you have to actually go out and do it. And if it's not authentic, you don't really know how to do it. You don't know how to be a coach that you think you're supposed to be. So you might as well go do it your way. And if it doesn't work and you get fired for doing it your way, at least you were upfront about it. You told them that you were going to do it that way. You did it that way. And you know what? It just didn't work out for whatever reason, but you can't be fake about it.
Yeah, the other part that you talked about is that you didn't really, you know, the first interview, they told you they got somebody else. You know, that could be tough on an ego. That could be tough on a young person that's now just starting, you know, to maybe get in the coaching that wants to coach in professional baseball. That's their goal. How do you handle that instant, you know, a little bit of, I guess you could use, it's not failure, but it's a setback.
If you're in this long enough, you're going to be told no a lot of times. And it's only going to take one yes. And so I think that's, like you have to put yourself out there. I've had conversations with a lot of coaches that, you know, want to move up in levels. And I've said, contact them, you know, reach out. What, you know, if you want to go coach at LSU, go send them an email. What are they going to say? No. Well, most of us aren't coaching at LSU or for the Dodgers. So like, it's okay to send an email and be told no. But you have to put yourself out there a little bit and be willing to hear no, in order to try and move yourself forward in your career. Otherwise you're just going to be stuck where you're at. And I know everybody says, and it's not fun to hear no, nobody wants to hear that.
Right.
But you know what, like in my early days of coaching, like I can't even tell you the jobs that I applied for that I either didn't get a response back to, told them, you know, was told I wasn't ready for it. You know, I was too young or whatever it was. But you know, it's just part of the process. If you're going to find a good job, you're going to be told no along the way. And you have to be able to deal with that. And if you can't deal with that part of it, it's going to be really difficult to move forward and be successful in this line of work.
Yeah. Great advice. And you know, the other part of this, you know, in the '90s, I got a call from a good friend of mine, Jay Ward, who passed away about 10 years ago. What a great manager in professional baseball, playing the big leagues. And Jay asked me, you know, you want to be a coach, you know, independent baseball, you know, in Thunder Bay, Canada. I didn't know what independent ball was. You know, I heard a little bit about it. There was professional, you know, a lot of pros in it, obviously AA, AAA, the Northern League at that time was the highest league and had a lot of big league guys in the league also. And one of the toughest things for me, and I want to ask you how it went with the Dodgers. One of the hardest things was transferring from high school collegiate players into a pro level, because you're thinking, wow, professional baseball, how am I going to deal with some of these guys? These guys are maybe a different level. So I was scared. There's no doubt about it. One, how did you handle it? And advice for, you know, coaches getting into that level, what to expect and what to kind of do so they don't do some of the wrong things. You know, one thing might be talk too much sometimes.
Yeah. It's hard for me I don't want it to sound like it's going to sound, but like I went from like freshman high school baseball to varsity, to junior college, to division one, to, you know, rookie ball. So like I've hit all those levels on the way and I've been intimidated at every single level too. Like you go from freshman baseball, I coached freshman baseball for 1 year. My next job, I was a head high school coach. And I was intimidated because now I'm the head coach and I go from making suggestions to making decisions. And All of a sudden you're like, man, I don't want to screw this up. And then, you know, you do the high school thing and you get used to it and you're comfortable where you're at in terms of your role and how you communicate with guys and what you teach and your ways that you teach them. And then you go into junior college and you're like, okay, now I've got older guys. Like now this is, you know, more mature, older guys. And then you get into junior college, you realize they're not necessarily more mature. They're still right. Kids, you know, they're still trying to play baseball and move forward. And, you know, the nice part, once you get there, is that they have that motivation to go from high school to college. And when you're in junior college, they've got the motivation to go from junior college to Division One. And when you're in Division One, they have the motivation to get into professional baseball. So there's always kind of that carrot dangling in front of them to work to get to the next level. For us as coaches, I think we always can be a resource for the players, regardless of where we're at. And we don't have all the answers. Like we don't have every answer. We're going to be a resource for those guys. And we're going to be a step in their path to college baseball or professional baseball or the big leagues, like wherever their career ends. All of us that coach those players are just kind of pieces of that puzzle that help put their career together and give them a direction or a path to take. And you know, we're there to help them. And once you get past that idea that, you know, this guy's got it figured out, they don't have it figured out. They're still working to figure it out. And they may be a little bit better physically. They may be a little bit more mature. They may have, you know, their own routine. They may have a better idea of what they're doing, but they're still working to get to where they want to go. So there's still stuff to learn. And you can still offer them stuff regardless of what level they're at.
How does Tony handle that? Let's say, you know, you started coaching. Now you got into it a little bit with the Dodgers. How did you handle the players? Were you progressive going, you know, to them and trying to help them? Were you waiting for them to come to you? Is there a middle ground there?
Yeah, I think there's some balance. I think part of it is, you know, you have to go in and know that, like, Nobody wants the super coach. You know, nobody wants the guy that's going to show up on day one and go, okay, I'm here. Like now we're going to start really hitting. you know, like, let me teach you how to pitch now. Like, nobody wants that guy. So you're much better off kind of going in, I think, feeling out the situation, you know, and get to know guys' personalities, because it's the adage, you know, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Like, and if you go in there and you start, you know, throwing around your advice because you have the tricks to coaching and the secrets that are going to make them big leaguers, you're going to lose them really quickly. If you get to know the guy, the person, the individual, and you connect with them and you start to have conversations with them, again, it doesn't mean you're going to be personal friends with them all the time. But you're going to be able to have something to connect with them. And I think that helps kind of buy you that equity with players where they now have that relationship with you, where sometimes it can turn a little bit easier into a conversation versus like a directive. So I think taking the time to get to know the players is really important. But you know, again, you can always offer up advice, but you just kind of have to tread carefully, I think, with how quickly you try to jump in there and make wholesale changes. Cause at some point they're going to go, wait, like, who are you? Why are you changing my swing? I don't know you.
Right.
But again, right or wrong, it's just kind of what it is. And I think the guys that take time to nurture those relationships are the ones that get the most out of what their players are bringing.
Yeah. I realize, you know, again, being in the game 39 years, I had a lot of players who were going into pro ball. And, you know, I guess I want to call them the old days, but there were great days. But in the old days, you know, sometimes I would hear this quite a bit. And that is, a player would, you know, in college would be hitting, you know, 390, you know, get drafted in the second round, third round. And then all of a sudden, the first 2 weeks of camp, they're already changing the swing. Those times have changed, it seems like, because that could really hurt mentally a player. It seems like now it's let's see what you can do and then make adjustments along the way if we need to.
Yeah. And I think that's a big deal too. I think that's really big. I think, you know, we've seen a lot, especially in college baseball, where, you know, guys get recruited and they are, you know, brought onto campus and, you know, it's like right away, okay, this is how we're going to hit. And it's like, well, why'd you recruit me? You know, if you're gonna bring me in to change me, why'd you recruit me? I could have gone to another school that was gonna let me hit this way. And the idea in professional baseball that you have to make changes right away, I think there are certain guys who know up front, like, listen, we know you're a good athlete and we know you've got the ability to hit, but we need to make changes in your swing. Like, there have to be changes made. Otherwise you're just going to get exploited. And because whether it's the numbers that show that you've already got a sufficient weakness in an area, and it's only going to get exploited more as you move up in the levels. But for the most part, there's a very specific reason for why there's going to be a change made. But the overwhelming amount of guys, you're right, there is that time given to fail. I think guys are much more susceptible to, you know, they're much more open to being coached once they've failed. I think it's difficult to say, and I know we just got you here, but, you know, let's give you a leg kick. Let's try that out. Let's see if this helps. Because a lot of times it's really unwarranted and there's not really a reason behind it. And the players are going to be skeptical to listen if they just feel like you're changing their swing for the sake of them swinging the way you want them to swing. So I do think that giving them that opportunity to fail, you have to be patient. And I think the payoff, the reward is much better if they've had that opportunity to fail versus you changing them right away from day one. They fail because they're going to tap. It will happen. They fail. And then they're going to really kind of be a little bit more, you know, apprehensive to listen to what you have to say, because you just wanted them to do it your way from the get go. So I do believe that giving them those guys the time to fail is it pays huge dividends down the road.
Yeah. Great point. And the other part is something I think that's changed a little bit, in coaching is now we're starting coach more the individual and not everybody the same, because we are all different, right? Whether we're coaches or players or whoever we are, we're all different and we probably need to be coached differently in some ways.
Yeah. You have different personalities and you have different, I mean, each guy is different. You know, each guy has a different background, especially once you get to this level, you have guys from multiple different countries, different cultures, different, I mean, you've traveled the world. Do you know how culturally things are different in different countries? And they may be slight differences, but that lands itself in college baseball, professional baseball, whether it's different countries, different states, different upbringings. I mean, you're dealing with different people. you're not dealing with robots. You're dealing with like dudes that are dealing with real stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we have players from other countries and things are not going so well in their countries and their families are in those countries and like, they're going to have bad days. And you have to remember that. You have to sometimes know like this dude needs his arm. You know, you need to put your arm around this guy and have a conversation with him and say, hey, you know, before we start working on ground balls today, like, how's your family? Everybody okay? Everybody good? Because that goes a lot further than, you know, you need to get your glove to this position or whatever. So yes, you're dealing with different people, different personalities, but you're also dealing with different athletes and everybody moves differently. Everybody has different strength or stability or mobility things that they can or can't do. And if those aren't addressed and you're not aware of those things, you may be asking players to do something that they physically can't do and they're going to fail because they can't do it. And then you're going to get frustrated as a coach because you don't know that they are incapable of doing these things, not from an effort perspective, but from a physicality perspective. So I think individualizing it as much as possible is huge.
Yeah. And you know, major league teams have done a great job. And I mean, they've all learned, everybody's learning along the way. You know, we get a Dominican kid or a Cuban kid coming in, doesn't speak the language. I know now they train them how to, you know, speak English, say some words, you know, the money, the food before they even get to the U.S. because it could be, like you said, it could be daunting, especially if your family's struggling in that particular country. You're worried about your family. There's a lot of factors behind that. I know teams are getting really good at making sure players are acclimated and coming here. And I say that because, as you know, I take teams around the world and, you know, for a cultural experience, I got U.S. kids that can't fly from Chicago to Miami on their own. And they're 17 years old. The parent says, why isn't anybody going to fly with them? I'm going, no, that's a great life experience. So could you imagine a Dominican kid coming from the Dominican Republic, never been out of there, next first time in the U.S., doesn't speak the language. Mm-hmm. That's awfully intimidating and tough.
Yeah. You know, you've been to the Dominican Republic. It's very different. It's not the same as it is in the United States. And so if you're a 16, 17 year old kid from the Dominican Republic, you don't know the culture here. You don't know the language. You don't know, you know, just how to get by on a day-to-day basis based on what we expect as a culture here, even outside of baseball, like even not even counting baseball. That's really difficult. And I think sometimes we have to remember that. And so when we're looking at these guys that are 17, 18 years old going, man, like I know he throws 102 miles an hour, you know, and he can do some things athletically, but he's still a kid and he doesn't quite know these things yet. And that's our job to teach him. It's not our job to get frustrated at him for not knowing. It's our job to teach him so that he doesn't make mistakes that, you know, could potentially have some lasting impact in a negative way if we don't do our job to teach him these things.
You know, Tony, the other part, the Dodgers, you know, obviously a very impressive organization for many years. I mean, you go back in the old days to the Dodger way, you know, when Lasorda and other managers were there, everything was systematically done certain ways throughout the whole organization, very professional. But and many teams are doing that nowadays. What, without giving away trade secrets, what are some of the things that separates the Dodgers possibly or that you really like that they do from an organizational standpoint with managers and coaches and players that's kind of special that we can learn from?
I think for one, the communication all the way down, you know, the idea that during spring training, you can walk in to go grab a water and, you know, on the minor league side and Andrew Friedman might be standing in there, or Dave Roberts might be in there. And when you see them, they're going to have a conversation with you. You know, we had Zoom calls with Dave Roberts and guys that are, you know, special assistants that play in the big leagues for a long time. So I think what the Dodgers do extremely well is they recognize how important the people are that are in the organization. And so they make the people the most important thing, whether it's the players, the coaches, everybody around, the whole staff. Doesn't matter what role you're in. You can be a groundskeeper. I mean, our head groundskeeper over here at our facility here in Arizona, you know, left for another job and he was presented with a World Series ring. So they take care of people and they make the people feel important. And it just goes back to show how important the people are that you are with on a daily basis. And you have to let the people you're working with, you got to let them work and you have to let them do their job. And they're there for a reason, you know, they're there for a reason and they have to be allowed to do their job. And so if you're a head coach somewhere, if you're going to bring coaches on to work with you or work for you or however you want to word that, you have to let them work and you have to let them do their job because there might be things as a assistant coach that they're better than the manager or head coach at. And sometimes you have to let that guy take those reins and let him go, because that might be what's best for the team, for the players. So I think that's one thing the Dodgers do really well, is they get really good people in, and they let us kind of do our job. They let us work, and they give us the resources to work too. Whether it's, you know, technology or just having access to people that can help us learn.
You know, and I love the part about how, you know, they make people feel comfortable no matter what level you're at, because, you know, my parents always taught me, treat people like you want to be treated. I don't care who they are, what level they're at. Everybody is equal as a human being. And when you're, you know, we talk about intimidation, I mean, pretty intimidating coming into the Dodgers as a coach first time. And imagine, you know, people not talking as much to you or all that, you know, that could be pretty intimidating. But when all of a sudden when you got open arms and they welcome you that way and they make you feel part of the family, that's special, man. That's, I mean, I love that.
Yeah. It's an environment that you're comfortable in because of the people that you're around, but you're comfortable because you know that you're going to be allowed to go do your job. You're going to be allowed to go work. And that you're going to be challenged. It's not to say like, hey, we're here for free hugs and, you know, let's make this a happy place. And, you know, it's a love fest, but I mean, you have a lot of really good people, but you've also got, we're the Dodgers. Like there are high expectations, as there should be, as you know, we should be expected to hold ourselves to a high standard. We should also expect that we're going to go put the work in with our players and we're going to challenge each other as staff members. We're going to challenge players, because the expectation is set very high. That bar is high. It's not just roll the balls out there. It's professional baseball and let's see what happens. It's there's a very, very serious way about going through our business, making sure that we're making everybody as good as we can. That means players and staff alike.
You know, one of the things I love is, you know, internationally, I've been in some meetings around the world with different people, organizations, and we might be in a meeting and they'll, you know, someone will say, does anybody have any questions? You know, well, a lot of times people are kind of hesitant to ask or any advice, to give advice. But there are other meetings where that person in charge says, Tony, what do you think? John, what do you, so they make you answer because they want your opinion and they want you to feel like you're part of the process. Is that the way the Dodgers do it?
Yeah, they value people's opinions because they know that there's potentially, you and me could be talking about the same exact thing, but you might say it in a way that your wording will resonate better with players, might resonate better with staff. Mm-hmm. So you have to hear everybody's opinions. You have to challenge people to give their opinions, and you have to make and allow people to feel uncomfortable giving their opinions, knowing that it might not be popular and it might get shot down. Right. But you give your opinion. It's like, if you're a head coach and you ask your staff members for their opinion, sometimes you want to hear it and you want to listen to them in terms of their way of doing something that may differ from what you as a head coach or manager might feel. But most of the time, the important part is allowing them to voice how they feel about a certain thing, because at least they feel like they're a part of the process and it's not just everything's being dictated to them. So there is that point where, you know, they want you to speak up and they want you to be involved and they want you to be active participants and not just nod your head and say, okay, yes, I'll do it this way. It's getting more towards this, I think, but there is a push to understand why. And I think it's something that needs to be done in all levels of baseball. Instead of saying, okay, this is how we're going to do, you know, pickoffs or rundowns, understand why. Like, there is a why behind why we're doing it this way. And if the players don't understand that, then they're not going to be able to execute it if something goes haywire. And it's going to. It's not always going to go well. It's not always going to go just like a drill setting does. So if you don't understand why we are doing something a specific way, you're not going to have the ability to adapt.
Yeah, and all you got to look at, and I love that part, because first of all, folks, coaches, if you're out there and you're a young coach, you know, even me recently, if I don't get asked a particular question, sometimes I'm hesitant about saying something. That's why I like a leader who opens up and says, hey, Tony, what do you think? But also on the other side, Tony, you know, the part about having, you know, coaches part of the process, what I like about it is that look at the game today in a lot of ways. I know some people criticize the game a little bit. And there's some things that you know, you may not agree with, but there's a lot of different ways to do things. And if we don't ask constantly why we don't find those new ways, right? I mean, otherwise you're stuck in your own bubble and you're never going to learn more.
Yeah. And I think that over the last few years, just kind of the shift that has happened in baseball, a few years back, I think some of the people that were throwing out some of these ideas that were kind of labeled as being just complete wackos in terms of, you know, like, what are you thinking? What are you talking about? And now they're everyday practices, right, which are now, you know, on the flip side, now being challenged, and the people that are challenging them are being criticized. In a couple of years, you might go, yeah, that guy was onto something by criticizing that or right, double checking it. So,
and really, sometimes if you're on social media, yeah, that can, it's a lot of times it's criticism, but if you really think about it, you're asking why, and why isn't this way better?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like why do you do it that way? Why do you want to do a specific movement this way? And the problem is the old idea of, you know, like when I first started coaching, I know my style of coaching 18 years ago was a lot different than it is right now, because I was a product of what I'd been around. And now you have the availability of different resources, whether it's, you know, social media or just coaches, coaches' willingness to connect and sit down and talk. Like, we can talk hitting. I'll sit down and talk hitting or catching with anybody because I feel like we're still going to do it better than anybody else. It's just what it is. I feel like with our players, with our staff, with our resources, we can talk about the exact same thing and we're still going to do it better. And so it's like, in terms of a of trade secrets, like, yes, there are things that we are trying to keep to ourselves as we feel they're competitive advantages. However, there's also things that we'll openly talk about because we still are comfortable and confident that we're going to be better at it than whoever we're talking to about it.
You know, and I could give you, which this is a great conversation. I'll tell you why, because I can give you two examples. Again, I'm not into it like you guys are, but I watch MLB a lot. I interview a lot of great people, I think. So that's why I do it, because I get knowledgeable by interviewing very good people. Two things. I'll give you an example I'm going to get your opinion on. Not too long ago, the one knee catching came in, right? Going on one knee. And great idea, right? I mean, lower strike zone. They, and I know scientifically they kind of understood that, hey, I'm still going to be quick, just as quick to go into second. I can still do that because I have to anticipate the pitch and all that and movement. But then the flip side, I've also videotaped a lot of guys on one knee in different organizations with a man on third, ball gets by because he couldn't block as well. Man on second, I got video of this, so it's not like, you know, people can't say it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. One knee, and he didn't block it, and the guy got the third. So the question then comes in, well, when do you do it? And then the big, really good experts explained it early. They said, you don't always do it all the time, and you don't always do it with all players. Does that make sense? I mean,
No, you're right on. And there are certain guys that I think because of the way that they move physically, they are better off being on one knee. They may not have, you know, a guy may struggle with his mobility in his hips. And so being on 2 feet, he actually may not block as well as he does from a knee. He may be limited going laterally because of just the width that he can get to. Maybe he has more mobility going one way or another. And so because of that, he actually is better off on one knee. I had Kyle Higashioka from the Yankees on my podcast, and I coached Kyle when he was in high school. And he says he feels like he blocks better on a knee. Now, the problem with that idea that I have is, while I do understand that and guys do block better from that position at times, there is the old school part of me that says, if I am as a catcher, if a ball gets by me and I'm on a knee, I'm going to feel terrible. Whether or not I am actually better at that skill at blocking from one knee or starting on one knee, I, as a catcher personally, would have a difficult time knowing that the ball got by me while I was set up on a knee. So, and it's the other side of it too, is while you're watching a game on TV and you see a guy on a knee and it's an 0-2 count and he throws a slider and he bounces a slider and it goes off of him, or he doesn't quite get there because he can't quite move enough laterally. When you're watching it on TV, you're going, man, what in the world are you doing on a knee? You it's 0-2, you called a slider, you know, he's not trying to elevate it. And like, it's supposed to be in the dirt. He threw it in the dirt and it got by you. That part's the part that for me personally, I'm still coming around to, because as much as I love the one knee catching, I'm in that old school boat where it's like, I don't want to see a ball get by a catcher when he was on a knee, because you knew that ball was supposed to be thrown down there. You're caught off guard. So I do struggle with that at times. And I know that it does help with receiving. I'm fully well aware of that. And I'm right there with Ryan, and, you know, I see our guys on a knee and I'm like, yes, that is a 100% improvement on his receiving being on a knee. But there's that little voice sitting on my shoulder that is, you know, from 20 years ago going, oh my gosh, like he's on a knee and there's a runner at third base. So still coming around to that.
And it's what we talked about too. It's individuals also you're dealing with, as you said, you know, different body types, you know, plus, I mean, I guess you can't argue that, you know, most of the game is receiving. There's more pitches, obviously, you receive than you do block. Then you have to determine the situation also. So I think that's interesting. I think that's a good conversation. And folks, if you're on social media, look, there's times I type stuff on social media and then I erase it because I said, this doesn't sound right. You need to ask a question, like Tony said, just ask why, or give your opinion and say, hey, listen, we do it this way. What do you think? Instead of criticizing that person for saying you go to one knee, don't criticize them. Ask the question. I think you get a lot, you know, you go a long ways, Tony, if you have a discussion more than if you have an argument.
Absolutely. And on top of that, you know, one of the things I see now is because of the emergence of social media, you know, and guys are using, from a coaching perspective, the way that they're using social media to try to propel their careers.
Yes.
You know, they're trying to tweet out their own personal feelings on things because they kind of have that thought that, you know, if I put out thoughts that are unique or challenging the status quo, that maybe that's going to make me stand out a little bit, and, you know, teach their own on that aspect. However, I also believe that it's not one way or the other. Just because guys are better receiving from a knee doesn't mean that everybody is going to be better receiving from a knee. Just because a guy blocks better from a knee doesn't mean everybody's going to be better blocking from a knee. So you have to kind of allow guys to play within that framework and let them try things, because you might, as a coach, you might be hesitant. The idea that has to go away is that it's lazy. It's not lazy. There's nothing lazy about being on a knee. That is the one thing that I do not agree with, is when people criticize the one knee setup and they call it lazy. There's just nothing lazy about it. It's been done for years. Tony Pena was on a knee all the time. Benito Santiago, like those guys did it and they were very good at what they did. So there's nothing lazy about it. They're trying to optimize what they can and what they can do. And they're trying to limit the things that they're not as good at. So
they could be also trying to maybe have a longer career. And I remember Manny Sanguin in the old days was, you know, down with one leg out, you know, trying to take stress off their knees, especially if there's nobody on base, and get that low. So let me ask you this, because since we're on this, and I really appreciate your time, some other things that I just brought up the one knee thing, but in general, some of the things you saw that are changing the game a little bit, that's kind of a good conversation that maybe was done in the older days that kind of changed now.
I think the hitting thing right now is really interesting. I think just as the one knee setup has gone to an extreme where people are doing it just because they see it and they don't understand the why behind it. I think the hitting thing has done the same thing. I think everybody, you know, pitchers were taught to pound the ball down in the strike zone. And so everybody was thinking, okay, well, we got to be able to get that ball in the air and try to drive that ball. So now it became this launch angle phenomenon that is the most overused term on social media that's not actually used in professional baseball settings. That's never been talked about in our cages. But it's this idea that we have to hit every single ball in the air. And you have to have a lot of length in your swing. And, you know, I get it. I understand why. And guys are making a ton of money hitting doubles and homers. But there's also guys that are becoming really easy to throw to, because they can't handle velocity up in the zone. Your swing is designed to lift the ball and to lift, you know, sinkers and sliders. And now you've got guys, the amount of guys that are throwing 100 miles an hour now is just insane. And they've got this heavy ride, the ball's staying up, and you're not going to get there. So I'm curious to see over the next couple of years, is there a shift back to, you know, being able to get above the baseball and hit the ball on a line and not think so much about lifting the ball, because not every count is a 2-0 count. you know, and I know the we'll call them the old school guys probably watch baseball and they're just kind of disgusted by it. You know, watching, I mean, on regular games, it's 11, 12, 13 punch outs. And that's got to drive guys crazy. And I think part of it is because the idea is that you can drive every single pitch in every single location. It's just not possible.
And Tony, you know, I really believe we've had this discussion on the show a few times. And again, with the pandemic, you know, I've watched more games than I've ever had in my whole life. And I think you're starting to see a shift in some of the hitters because
I do too.
Look at the Dodgers. I mean, and again, you know, Dodgers better than anybody, but I look at the Dodgers as an outsider. Okay. When I saw them in the World Series, man, I saw a lineup of guys, not only that they, you know, sure, they got power, but they also can battle you. And they hit in situations, they hit the other way. I mean, there's different things that they do. They really battle you 1 through 9. And the impressive part, which I didn't realize, because, you know, everybody thinks about the Dodgers, oh, you got a lot of money, you know, you're just buying players. Well, no, they got a lot of homegrown players. And that's what I want to get into in a minute. It was about the player development with the Dodgers. Got a lot of homegrown players who have moved up through the system who are stars in you know, with the Dodgers now.
Yeah, and that's a huge source of pride. I mean, those guys that had come up with us. I mean, you know, look at that roster from last year's World Series team. The amount of guys that came up, you know, drafted by the Dodgers or signed by the Dodgers, it was incredible. And I think it was even more in 17 or 18. I believe it was even more those years of guys that had come up and. That were homegrown talent. And so that it is a huge source of pride for us because we know that for one, we know as coaches, we're going to have an opportunity to coach players that are going to have the chance to move up in our organization. And for players, I think it's positive because they see that if you do well with the Dodgers, you're going to have a chance to move up. And it's not like other organizations that as soon as you do well, they're going to trade you and get major league value. You know, there obviously it happens everywhere. But with the amount of homegrown players that we had on our World Series roster, that's got to be motivating for players to see that if you do well, you're going to have a chance to move up and you're going to have a chance to play for our major league organization.
Absolutely. And Tony, you know, when we talk player development, I don't think people understand in a lot of ways how important it is because, you know, I'll use Houston because the stats came up yesterday. Okay. Leading the league in runs scored, leading the league in less strikeouts, leading the league and hitting the ball more in play, putting the ball in play. These are all things that they're leading the league in. And Houston's a pretty successful team right now, doing really well. Forget the controversy in the past, because right now they're doing it real time. Mm-hmm. That doesn't start when you get to the big leagues and the coaches start working with you. That starts 4, 5, 6 years down in the minors, that the organization has that mentality and keeps that mentality and that training in the system, correct?
Yeah. And there's a constant reminder that, you know, we are trying to create guys and trying to help them understand themselves and the things that we're pushing for them to do and know and understand about themselves and about the game are for things that hopefully in 4, 5, 6 years, help us win a World Series. And it's not about, it may not for our purposes here in rookie ball, it might actually not serve us as well tonight to win a ball game, but it might serve us well in 5 years to win a World Series game in the big leagues. And so that reminder is kind of always there for us that, you know, we're trying to get guys ready to go compete in the big leagues. And that's our goal. That's our job. You know, we want to create and help guys understand themselves as baseball players so that when they're in that position, when they're in that arena later on, that they've been there a million times, and they can go back and they can recall those experiences they've had in rookie ball and low A and high A all the way up, being prepared for that moment. And it's not about necessarily tonight. It's about, you know, their overall development. And then we are fortunate in this level that we can do that. It's hard to do that when you're in college baseball. You know, that might be the biggest difference I've seen is, you know, sometimes you can't do that. You can't sacrifice a Friday night game for the sake of, you know, hopefully winning in 3 years. Right. You got to win tonight and you got to win at all costs, really.
You know, and that brings up a great point because I was thinking about it as you're talking, you know, mentally as a coach, you went through high school, college, you know, and it's about winning. You got to win, especially in college. I mean, coaches have to keep their jobs. So it is winning. Of course, you're developing, you know, human beings and you're getting them ready for the real world. But at the same time, you got to win. Also, now you're in pro ball in the minors where winning, sure, you're going to try. Everybody's going to try to win the game they're playing, but it's really about development. Mentally, how did you deal with that? Now you're a manager. So now, you know, instinctively you want to win, but at the same time, you got to think long-term. How'd you make that adjustment as a coach?
I'm still trying to. It is, because there's times where, you know, the game situation might call for you to give a guy a 3-0 take because, you know, whatever, we're late in the game, you know, the score is dictating it. But for that guy that happens to be up at this moment, he needs to be able to swing 3-0. He needs to not be handcuffed in this position. And so we've got to let him swing it. And there could be a really positive result that, you know, he's able to draw from later on down the road. There could be a negative result that, you know, causes him to be fearful to swing at 3-0. But you hope that situation comes up again quickly and he gets another opportunity to do that. But you're always kind of keeping that in mind. And sometimes that does supersede the need for what that specific game moment might tell you.
You know, the show, obviously, Baseball Outside the Box, Thinking Outside the Box, asking that question why all the time. I'm pretty open-minded, especially coming, if you know, and I don't know if it's the right word. We keep using the word old school because I think there's old school, new school mixed in. It's great school to me because you just learn it from everybody. But at the same time, there's some things that I'm not in favor of right now unless somebody can convince me, because I think the game's changing. But the question is, you know, I still love to see steals, hit and runs, bunts in certain situations, not because you want to bunt or not early in the game to give up and out. I'm not in favor of all that kind of stuff, but I still am in favor of playing the game and winning any way you can. Okay. Mm-hmm. If winning is the name of the game, then winning and with all the arsenals that you could produce, the Dodgers, is that in their system? Is that in their mentality? Do you guys work on bunting a lot? Do you work on certain things? What are some of the things that you work on that transfers into the big league club, the big leagues?
I think we try. Yeah, we'll bunt. We do bunt. We work at it because, you know, you don't know when you're going to need to do that. I mean, right. Last year in the World Series, Kike Hernandez laid down a bunt or popped up a bunt in a situation that, you know, I don't know if he's been in that situation in quite some time. You know, and it's difficult to ask a guy to do something that he hasn't done. So you do have to work at it because you don't know when you're going to need it. So yeah, we'll work on it. But we probably don't do it in as much in games as, you would think would happen, simply based on the fact that, you know, the right personnel has to be up. You know, if it's a prospect that's hitting and rookie ball and there's a runner at second base and nobody out, and this is a guy that we're going to see being in the big leagues in 3, 4, 5 years. He's not going to be bunting in the big leagues. And so he's not going to bunt now in rookie ball. Right. And it's kind of what it is. You know, maybe you do when you have that guy that, you know, is an 8-9 type hitter who is probably going to be an organizational type guy, probably not a prospect, probably not going to make it to the big leagues, you know, in that shorter time frame if he does. So you do maybe bunt that guy over, but somebody that is, you know, a guy that we are pushing to really be in that, you know, that prospect list type area, you know, that's just not a guy that we're going to have a bunt because it's not something he's going to have to do later on down the road.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, a guy like Bellinger, you know, why, mm-hmm. you know, he's there to do a job. That's the drive-in runs, you know, doubles, whatever, home runs, where however you can drive him in. So that's very understandable. I just hope that the game doesn't get away from it. And watching games more now, I see more teams actually bunting than I have ever before, whether it's a sacrifice bunt, but more safety squeeze. I've seen a couple squeezes, you know, and it makes the game exciting too. Here's the other part of all this, and this might be a tough question from the standpoint of development. When you talk about electronic strike zone, right? Because I'm in favor of it, but in some ways I'm not. So you can kind of sway me one way or the other. What I'm worried about is this. I'm going to get your opinion about it and maybe how the Dodgers may look at it. We talk about electronic strike zone. Talk about a possible rule where the pitcher is going to have to step off before he picks. Okay. These are all to speed up the game, to make it more fun and all that. My problem is, where's the coaching going to be? Do we need coaches anymore? Because if you have an electronic strike zone, you don't have to frame anymore. There's no framing. If you have, you know, have to step off, you know, before you pick a guy off, you don't have to teach base stealing because the guy's going to get a huge jump. So what I'm afraid of is we're getting away from player development and teaching the game a little bit. What's your thoughts on that?
So my personal thoughts.
There you go.
But I'll preface it with my humble opinion. I hate it. I do. I hate the direction of where things are at right now. I do. I hate everything about it. I want to keep my job. I know Ryan would like to keep his job, you know, and if you're not teaching receiving, which is a massive part of catching, who catches? Do you just put like some big old donkey back there that can hit and doesn't need to be able to catch? He's just a big target. I mean, there's guys, it's like when they took away the pitcher rule where you have to face, you know, three hitters, there's guys that are left-handed specialists that are out of a job that served a great role in baseball. Like you have to go get this guy out. Like your job tonight is to go get Cody Bellinger out, and that's it. And if you did it, you did good. And if you didn't, you didn't do good. And why? Like, why take that away? Because are the games really shorter? And also, do people really care? I don't think people care. I don't think people care if you take 10 minutes off of a baseball game. People are going to go for the entertainment in terms of a fan. The average fan is just going to go because it's a thing to do with their family on a night that, you know, you want to get everybody out of the house and go do something. So changing and in my opinion, ruining the game is not worth it for the fans' perspective of shortening a game by 10 or 15 minutes, which it hasn't. I think it was like on average 2 minutes shorter. Like that is completely unnoticeable by anybody's standards. So they're changing these things that have been in baseball that have made baseball great. They're taking away strategy from a manager's position. They're taking away coaching positions because like now what you're going to get people that are good with rules and you're going to get people that are good at just reading information and giving them to players and, you know, catching the art of catching just is going to be gone. Like, I don't think people are going to like the electronic strike zone. I think you're going to get a guy that throws from a low arm slot and a ball's crossing the zone and a stitch is going to hit that corner and the catcher's going to catch a ball a foot and a half off the plate because it's happened in the Arizona Fall League. You see some egregious pitches getting called strikes that you would never see called strike by a person, nor should it be. But there, you know, the shift rules that they're coming up with, what you get 9 guys on defense, let them play wherever they want to play. Who cares? Why does it matter? You know, like how is that going to help the game? If my job is to get you out, if I need 5 outfielders, I'm going to put 5 outfielders out there because I think you can hit. I just don't understand why they need to make all these changes. And it's turning into like the XFL, you know, it's not like football. It's football with funky rules. You know, the step off rule is just completely asinine to me. You know, now you get a guy throwing a ball into the stands and it's 2 bases because he's now a fielder because he's not engaged with the rubber. You know, you get 2 attempts at a pickoff. Well, what happens on that 3rd one? If the guy just gets a massive lead, if you engage with him, he gets a free base. Like now we're just giving away free bases. And you don't have to do anything. Like it's stupid in my opinion. And it's ruining the game.
Yeah. You know what? You bring up some great points and don't worry about getting fired because remember the Dodgers are open-minded and one opinion. So we got that on tape. No. And hopefully I'm not the one to get you fired.
I prefaced it with, it's my opinion.
And then I feel really bad. No, those are all great points. And again, jumping back to player development. I mean, that's what the game's all about. You know, even when you're talking about the shift, I get it. Guys are throwing 100 miles an hour, but eventually in the minors, you're teaching guys to hit the ball where it's pitched, whether it's 100 miles an hour or not. If it's pitched away, you're hitting it away. I mean, that game hasn't changed. Why can we? I mean, I talked to Reggie Smith. So there's no reason. Reggie, you know, an all-star. I mean, he should be almost in the Hall of Fame. He said there's no reason why somebody can't. If they're throwing the ball away, there's no reason why you can't go the other way if that's how you train them in the minors.
And if you know that shortstop, your left-hand hitter is going to be over, if you really want to, you can bunt. It's there. It's there for you if you want to take it. And if you want to see, somebody hit for a high average, it's going to be the left-handed hitter that's got some power that instead of hitting, you know, 30 homers is going to hit 20 homers and he's going to take his extra 20 hits on the third base line because he can lay down a bunt. I mean, that's where you're going to start seeing. If you want to get rid of the shift, have guys start laying bunts down hit balls the other way and beat the shift. And now they're going to say, okay, he's willing to do this. So we're going to take that hit away. You know, if a guy adds a hit, you know, every couple of games because he's willing to bunt, I think you're going to be less likely to shift on him. But again, who cares where they play? I don't understand why they care where you're playing defensively. It doesn't make any sense because there's ways around it. And I'm sure these guys who were able to handle the bat a little bit are looking at this going, man, just there's a hit for you. I mean, they were doing everything in their power to get a hit. And now they're going, well, I'm not going to take my free hit that's right there because I need to pull a ground ball.
And that's what I love. I'm here in Chicago, but there's several players that are doing this. I love like Anthony Rizzo, who has a plan with two strikes. You know, he'll choke up, you know, and if he has to, he'll go the other way. You know, make adjustments according to what the game's giving you. Hey, listen, time's coming close here, but I want to ask you about this. You know, being a manager now, what are some of the adjustments you had to make from coaching to managing? That can give some advice to our coaches out there that are assistant coaches that may end up, you know, managing one day.
For me, and I started last year when I was going to be managing in Ogden, you know, obviously COVID shut that out. But the biggest thing for me is at this point, you know, understanding the players as people and allowing the coaches to coach. And we all have jobs in terms of what we have to do with coaching the players. But you've got your staff of coaches that you have to make sure that they're in the best position to impact the players. Because those guys, if you're a head coach, the assistant coaches are probably going to have more hands-on time with the players in terms of skill development than you are as the manager or head coach. You have to make sure that those guys all have autonomy to go out and coach the players that they're at the positions that they're in charge of. And not micromanage guys. You know, we were playing the other night during an extended game and it was great. You know, our coach has been working with the catchers is outstanding. Like he does a great job. You know, he's constantly in communication with Cienko, you know, talking about catching and their young dudes. And, you know, he's doing our runner control because he's got the relationship with the catchers right now. Cause he's been spending the most time with them. Our infield coach is doing the infield positioning. Our outfield coach is doing the outfield positioning. You know, you're allowing those guys to kind of be good at what they're good at. You know, you as the head coach, you don't have to do everything. You know, you can have other guys do things that are going to take a little bit off of your plate and focus a little bit more on personnel and overall game strategy. You know, again, we don't know everything. And so you have to allow and really promote the idea that other people are going to be doing a lot of things to help you win games and not try and do it yourself.
You know, I love that. And on the flip side, let me ask you this, because I see us going in a tough direction. And I say this because what we talk about a lot is long-term development for young players. What meaning mm-hmm. you train them long-term to do things correctly and help them and ask questions and have them be proud of the process. That player will stay in the game longer because they're successful and they love what they're doing. Look, I hear this all the time. Oh, by 12 years old, 13, they quit because of other things. Look, we were all 12 and 13. Yes, we're going to quit if we're not having fun. But yeah. If I really love baseball and I'm having a great time at it, I'm not quitting. I don't care what you throw at me. So my question is this, because my concern is this. I think we're micromanaging players too much at the young levels. We're not allowing them to play the game on their own, develop instincts and all that. I want you to talk to the coaches at the younger levels on some advice on what they should be making sure they do with their young kids. So those kids learn the game better, love it, and progress to higher levels.
Let them play baseball. Yeah. Let them play. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to strike out. They're going to make errors and they're going to walk guys. And don't be shocked when that happens. There's youth baseball is very difficult because I think the coaches are, you're right, micromanaging. The kids have so much pressure on them because they think recruiting is happening so much earlier. I mean, there's kids that are 12, 13 years old that are already thinking about recruiting. And a lot of it comes from the fact that their parents are thinking about it. You're not getting recruited when you're 12 or 13. So just go play baseball and have fun. You don't even know what you're going to be, you know, good at or bad at. You don't know what position you're going to play. Like these kids that only want to play shortstop when they're 12, you know how hard it is to be a shortstop in professional baseball, I mean, chances are you're not going to be a shortstop if you get drafted. You're going to move around. You could play second, you could play third, you could be moved to the outfield. You have to be really good to play shortstop in professional baseball. There's a lot of colleges, there's a lot of players at Division I schools and big conferences that are shortstops that don't go and play shortstop in professional baseball. And it's a difficult position to go to. Catchers, same way. You know, kids are, you know, they hide guys in the outfield. Well, there's big leaguers that play outfield. So they need three of those on every team as well. So put them out there and let them develop that too. But move kids around, move them around, let them play. What are you afraid you're going to lose a game when they're 12? I mean, it's not the end of the world. I promise you can play again. We're getting to a dangerous place where social media is full of, you know, the kids holding up their rings from their Memorial Day tournaments. And nobody really cares that you won a Memorial Day tournament when you were 12, when it comes to recruiting time or professional baseball time. And yes, it seems like a big deal at that time, but you know, you're doing things that really are never going to be applicable to the game in order to win a tournament. So for coaches' sakes, like let kids go play and you don't have to give them a reminder after every pitch. Like let them figure it out. Let them figure out how to make adjustments on their own without the coach or the parent yelling from the stands what their, you know, individual batting coach told them to do. Like let them figure it out and address it with them later on. But there's just too much in-game coaching going on, and we're turning these kids into robots. We just got to let them go play.
You know, and the other part is, you know, teaching coaches around the world, I always stress to them, let them play, let them make decisions, because it's fun making a decision, right? The ball's in front of you. You make the choice if you go to next base. We don't need if the ball's in front of you, what do we need a coach telling you? And the coach will say, well, I can make a better decision for them. But the point is, how are they going to learn to make decisions on their own? What's your philosophy there?
They're not going to learn. And it's the same thing if the kid that's 12 years old that throws the ball to the wrong base. You can sit there and yell at the kid that he threw the ball to the wrong base, but why not just walk up to him and go, hey, why'd you throw it to second instead of third? What were you thinking? Like, what? Give me your thought process and have them talk about it. And when they say, well, you know, I thought he was going to be safe at third, so I was throwing to second base to keep the double play in order. Okay, great. Maybe you as the coach are thinking, we got to try to throw that ball to third base. And when that, you know, the hitter goes backside and slides into second safely, you're not going to be happy then either. So like ask the kid, instead of telling them, try to ask them. And I think that was one of the first big lessons I learned in coaching was like, ask questions and allow players to explain to you what they did and why they did it and what they were thinking, what their thought process was. Because it's not, we don't always have the answers. They're on the field and they might actually have a better answer than we do. And if they are wrong, the opportunity to learn comes from them saying it and explaining why they did it. And then you as the coach saying, okay, you know, I understand where you're coming from and why you did that, but here's why this may have been a better decision. And the next time that play happens, like that kid may make a different or better decision, but it's because he's learning, not because you told him to. When you tell him to do something, you know, again, it's just, they become robotic and they need to be able to learn to play. They need to be able to learn to make decisions. They need to learn what their limits are as players at a young age. Yeah, get thrown out. Like the worst thing that's going to happen, we still talk about on dirt balls, go get thrown out. Like that's the worst that's going to happen is you're out. So what? Like it's not that big of a deal. But you as a player just learned, I've got to get an earlier read on a dirt ball, or I've got to see kick, you know, left or right on the dirt ball versus, you know, it was a deep fastball and the guy was able to pick it and come up and throw me up by 50 feet. But if they don't go and you don't promote the idea of them making aggressive mistakes, they're going to play scared. They're going to be timid. They're going to, you know, be very passive in their decision-making. And so they're not going to get any better.
You know, that's what I love about the show. And that's, you know, not only all this advice is great advice. It's not only for coaches, but also helps parents. Cause I know we have parents that listen to the show, and kids, you know, at the same time. Tony, this has been fantastic. Let me finish it off with this. Because I was just in Kentucky, you know, and stopped at the whiskey bourbon place. And I know you're a big whiskey bourbon person. Podcast, Barrel Proof Baseball. You know, got to mention it. Tell everybody what it's about, how to get it and all that, how to listen to it and go, and some of the guests you have.
Yeah, I mean, I started it just because I actually liked learning about bourbon. That was kind of the start of it. And then a couple years ago, some guys I work with, we were over in Ireland working with their national team over there. And, you know, we ended up going to some of the distilleries and doing some tours and really kind of fell in love with the process of it and just the information and history. So got into a little bit more and I was at work one day and we're out in the outfield shagging. And one of the guys I work with was like, man, you got to do something with like whiskey and baseball. And so I kind of started a Facebook group and Instagram and then kind of got the podcast going. And so, you know, it's based around baseball and whiskey. And I've seen there's been kind of a crossover between people in baseball that enjoy whiskey and people that are in whiskey that enjoy baseball. So kind of got that going. And so I've had a lot of different distillers on. They could be, you know, distillers or owners of brands or brand reps or something from whiskey companies. You know, baseball wise, I've had Kyle Higashioka was on, Chris Gordon, the pitching coach at Duke, Tim DeJean is a minor league coach with the Orioles. Dylan Nishaka is one of our hitting coaches. Cienko is going to come on. I'm going to make sure he's on with me. Chris Jimenez is going to come on. He's a former big league catcher, and probably he'd want me to say he's a former big league pitcher as well, because he pitched a few innings, and so now he's a pitcher. So it's been fun. That part's been a lot of fun.
And how do you go to it? How do you get to the podcast?
It's on Apple, Google, Spotify. It's on YouTube. It's called Barrel Proof Baseball. So you can check them out on any one of those platforms.
Awesome. Folks, check it out. Hey, listen, I'm going to let you close the show off for our coaches. Last minute advice that you just want to give them when it comes to coaching.
Let the players play. Let them play. Let them make mistakes. Teach from the mistakes that they make. Teach through asking questions. You don't need to be the one giving them directives all the time, telling them what they need to do. You know, come up with a plan of how you're going to make players better and allow them to make mistakes. You know, promote the idea that they can be aggressive and make mistakes, and don't hammer them for making mistakes, because that's how you turn aggressive players timid very quickly. So let them go play.
Awesome. Great way to end the show. And folks, just so you know, never met Tony. First time in my life. I communicated a little bit with him through email. I just found out that his brother was one of our coaches traveling internationally to the Puerto Rico. Boy, it's just a small world of the game. Tony, yeah. Can't thank you enough, man. This has been fantastic.
Definitely. Thanks for having me on, Pete.
All right, folks. That's Tony Cappuccelli. I'm Pete Caliendo. This is Baseball Outside the Box. Don't forget, check us out, baseballoutsidethebox.com and the audio ESPN Honolulu. Also, Facebook at Peter Caliendo. We've got YouTube, Peter Caliendo. All we ask is that you subscribe to the show. That's it. Subscribe. Help us out. Because of you, we've been able to get to over 100 countries. We just want to keep expanding and giving you the best coaches that we feel that can give you the best advice when it comes to baseball coaching development long term. Thanks, folks, everybody. Happy Father's Day. God bless y'all. Stay safe, healthy, and God bless y'all.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.